Hello, this is Paul Johnson with The Optimistic American. Dr. Bashaw and I today are going to bring you an exciting program today where we're going to talk about idealism. Now, idealism gets a very bad word. A lot of people see it as being negative, but this is kind of the Platonic idealism that that Plato spoke about, where idealism makes a huge difference, not only in one's life, but in the aspirational goals that we have for ourselves and our friends and our country. The key is that you're being bombarded with negative messages by political parties, by political candidates, by the news media on a nightly basis. And that's programming you. That's wiring your brain in a way in which is prohibiting you from being able to get to the best of you. We're going to talk about how it is that you tap into that subconscious and release that aspirational part of you, and how you do that through not only visualization, but through idealism. Again, this is Paul Johnson. Now, while we're doing this, we're hoping you'll press that subscribe button. It won't cost you anything. And what it does is it helps us continue our work. Again, I'm here with Dr. Bashaw, Paul Johnson, the Optimistic American. We're going to talk about hope. Dr. Emily Bashaw, welcome today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk about all of this today, the philosophy, also linking in all the different materials that we've added to the podcast leading up to this. I think going back and just summarizing, I think one of the most important things is the negative bias. You know, what we allow ourselves to be influenced by through the media, through the news, through social media outlets, through people who hate and negative biases, that's all going to influence what's going on inside of us. And we're trying to say, you know, take accountability for yourself, but also how can you move yourself to being more idealistic and believing in something and have the courage to create the life that you want to live? We are bombarded with messages outside of ourselves and also some negative messages from within. We're saying don't become a creature of habit and be selective about what you allow yourself to be influenced by.
Yeah, the you know, I know that today as we're talking about this whole idea of idealism, it's important to focus on this concept. Most of the people that you will find that are successful financially, and I'm not talking about people who inherited their money, but people who've been able to find success financially or politically, or for that matter, even in their occupation or in their jobs or with their family, they all have to be a little bit of an idealist. They have to be able to come up with what they believe is the greater concept that they're trying to accomplish. They have to be able to figure out how to visualize that. And by the way, visualizing it becomes a very, very important part of being able to actualize the goals that you have.
Yes. And remember that our brains are hardwired to pick up and focus on those negative messages. So you have to consciously focus on this visualization and this life that you want to live and create and what you're allowing yourself to be influenced by.
You know, no doubt the human mind is designed to be programmed. It's just designed to. I remember with my sons when they were growing up and they were little boys, I hated this song by Vanilla Ice, Ice Ice Fever, right?
And
I
was Ice Ice Baby,
excuse me. But in any event, these my boys would turn this song up. They must have listened to it 10,000 times. But, you know, in the very beginning, I hated it. I found myself after 2 weeks of listening to it over and over again, literally walking around during the day at work going, Ice Ice Baby, right? Singing the song. We're designed to be programmed. And the environment that you put around you begins to have an incredible effect on how it is that we're being programmed. The average programming that is happening for people today in the United States is a very negative one. If you're watching the nightly news, it's a very negative message. If you're listening to our politicians, it's very negative. If you're listening to the messaging being put out by the political parties, it's very negative. And here's the thing. It's not the truth. It's not the truth of who we are nor where we are. It's so far out of perspective that it distorts the existing reality. you have to come up with aspirational ways to be able to look at these issues if you're going to find success and to know that you're being programmed. And part of that is about what are you doing to find external programming that can affect you, but what are you doing internally to program yourself as well?
So you've talked about idealism. Can you define idealism for us? You know, that there's really no self-made entrepreneurs that are not idealists, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you can't do that without digging into the philosophers. And clearly one of the philosophers that changed my life, one of the readings that changed my life, was written by Plato called The Republic. And I love the allegory of the cave. I think it's called The Divided Line. But what Plato was doing when he was writing that, I'm going to go a little bit deep onto this, but I really think it helps make the point about how idealism is actually real, how what we think is usually more real than what we see in real life. Now, what Plato was doing, remember, Socrates had gone up on trial, and he'd gone up on trial basically for philosophy, for promoting philosophy. And they had a group of people that judged him, and by a very slim majority, they found him to be guilty.
Yeah, the people, or I think that the judges believed that he was corrupting the minds of the youth.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so, but when they got down to sentencing him, mm-hmm. he made the speech, and he said, "Okay, you want me to tell you what my sentence should be? You should give me a lifetime pension. You should pay me the rest of my life for the great things that I've done for you and your people." Now, that ticked them off, and so they sentenced him to death. And many more people voted to sentence him to death than people who actually said that he was guilty. Now, that Plato was one of his students. If you look at the lineage, it went Socrates. One of his students was Plato. Plato actually created one of the first universities. One of his students was Aristotle, and then one of Aristotle's students, a very famous person, was Alexander the Great. So there's this lineage that exists between them. But a lot of people will say in philosophy that all philosophy is a footnote to Plato, meaning the things that he talked about were so great and so earth-changing that you just have to recognize him as being one of the foundations, the pillars of where all modern philosophy is derived from. Well, he created what we call Platonic idealism. And Platonic idealism was based upon, he used the idea of a triangle. He said, if you go up to a board and you draw a picture of a triangle, everybody would look at it and they would recognize it and say, "Oh, that's a triangle. That's what a triangle is." But his argument is, no, that's just a representation. A triangle has certain properties that it has to meet. And those properties include, you know, equaling 180
angles
degrees and what
dimensions.
The angles look like. His point was that there's this aspirational goal in your mind as to what a perfect triangle is. But when you draw the triangle on the board, it's never perfect. It's not a true triangle. It's just a representation of the triangle. The real triangle.
But we come to some kind of shared meaning and understanding of what that representation is.
But it's in the mind.
Mm-hmm.
That shared representation is in the mind. And what he did is he said that there are real life things that play into these forms. And these forms end up becoming the real representation, or excuse me, the reality of what an object is. So even in human beings, you could say, well, those are all human beings. You say, yeah, but one is a male, one's a female. And then one has black hair and one has blonde hair and one has curly hair. One has another one is short, another one's tall. But we could still say, yeah, but within the form of them, they fit within that. So there were thousands of forms. Now, finally, the question was asked by his student, by Aristotle, who said, well, wait a minute. If you have all these tens of millions of things on Earth that go into these forms, is there something above that?
Mm-hmm.
Is there something above that that all those forms play into? And he said, yes. He, like Plato, he wasn't going to leave it without an answer, but he said, that's called logos. Now, logos has been misunderstood quite often, but the whole concept of logos was that it's all rational thought. It's the rationality behind the universe that all of these forms play into, and it is a greater thinking. Now, we use logos in you know, when we think about psychology, the L-O-G-Y, when we think about biology, oftentimes we think about that as the study of
therapy,
or logotherapy, the study of science, or the study of the mind. But really, it's more than that. It's the rational, natural laws of the universe.
It's the root.
As they apply to science. That's right. It's the root. Mm-hmm. It's the base. It's the beginning. And his view was that that reality was more real than what you actually see in front of you. And that's the allegory of the cave.
Okay, so I have a question here, because this can be quite confusing, because I know we had talked about postmodernism before, and now you're starting to sound more like a social constructionist and a postmodernist. So help maybe tease that apart.
Yeah, I would say that the postmodernist, their view is that everything is relative, that there can be that it is only your perception that matters, right? And I don't think that's really what Plato was saying. What Plato was saying was that there was an ideal form that existed in each of these items. And more importantly, what was he really trying to do? He really wasn't trying to talk about triangles or physical objects. He was trying to talk about characteristics, but he utilized those objects as a means to make it more concrete. What he was really trying to do was to address that primary issue that happened with Socrates being killed. And the point that he was trying to make was, it wasn't justice that more of you decided to kill him than those of you who found him guilty. That was your emotions. You were allowing your emotions to take part as opposed to true justice being implemented. And his belief was that thoughts like courage and justice and truth, all those had higher aspirational values and that they were real. Now, if you say what's in the mind isn't real, only things that are concrete are real, well, then things like courage and justice and truth don't exist.
An aspiration.
Right, because that's right, because those are just thoughts. Mm-hmm. Well, his view was, no. That what is in the human mind is more real. The thought that we have is more real than what exists here on Earth. Now, our founders loved, they read the Stoics. They read antiquity. They understood Greek culture much better than even we do today. And much of what they did was formed on that concept. So when you listen to even the Declaration of Independence or the preamble to the Constitution, you will see those forms that take place in it. So in the Constitution, as an example, when I was growing up, everybody had to know the preamble, right? I don't know that that's true today, but I know that it was important when I was growing up. And it starts with this: we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. I just want you to think about that for a moment. Just think about that concept. In order to form a more perfect union. They already had a union. It fell under the monarchy. It fell under the king. They weren't telling us they were going to create a utopia overnight. They weren't telling us that what they were going to create was going to be nirvana. They said it's going to be more perfect than the one we have. Now, to do that, they had
again, that's aspirational, going back to what inspires us.
That's right. And so then they went on to say that they were doing that to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, to promote the general welfare, and to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and posterity, right? Mm-hmm. Those are all forms.
Yeah, they're intangible.
That's right.
And they're beliefs in something greater than us, but it gives us something to drive towards. It's that navigational tool.
That's right. Now, in the Declaration of Independence, they did the same thing, right?
There, it's the sextant.
That's right. The sextant is the same thing.
Right there.
Right, the sextant, so nobody thinks it's some type of sexual device, is actually a device used by navigators to be able to look at the stars and to determine the direction that they were going to be able to go. Visualizing that goal became very, very important. It became an important aspect of it. But in the Declaration of Independence, it was, we hold these truths. Now think about that for a moment. Truths. Truth in itself is aspirational. Mm-hmm. It's idealistic in itself. They didn't say we hold these facts. They said, we hold these truths. So they were saying that there are a set of concepts that we're basing the foundation of our country around. We hold these truths to be self-evident, right? That all men are created equal. Now, again, a greater concept, but we can look back on it and go, whoa, 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 you only allowed African-Americans to be two-thirds of a person. How was that perfect? Well,
yeah,
it wasn't designed to be perfect. It was designed to be better than what they were leaving, but to have aspirational goals that they knew that would go beyond it. There were many, many people back then who knew that slavery was wrong. They understood that it was wrong. Mm-hmm. They also knew that they wouldn't be able to take that first step if they weren't able to get an agreement amongst the people who were then second in power in the United States. Not first in power, because first in power was the king and the monarchy.
So how do we then evaluate or determine which thoughts are more superior to others or have a greater value? I mean, I think our founders must have struggled with this. Like, at what cost, you know, are these values more superior to these other truths?
So,
and there is, there's one other quote I wanted to mention, because I think it does link in, which is Nietzsche. And he said, you know, and those who were seen dancing were thought to be insane by those who could not hear the music. And so it's just, you know, again, to bring a bit of balance to what you're sharing here, is at what point do we merge these thoughts that are not tangible in reality, but yet converge into something aspirational or an idealistic, and that we can express and experience joy despite what is happening externally to us?
Okay, I love that quote, mm-hmm. but I would have you think about it in this way. The single greatest thing that happened in this country, overwhelmingly. Now, government has done some amazing things, no doubt about it. We have, we've created bridges and freeways, and we've taken men to the moon. We've done some amazing things. But the single greatest thing that government ever did was it empowered the individual over itself. Mm-hmm. Now, we did that through the Bill of Rights, which had in it not only the Second Amendment, which we spent a lot of time arguing about today, but freedom of speech, freedom of religion, the ability to assemble. It also had in it property rights, the ability to guarantee you property rights. Patents were included in it, meaning intellectual property rights were included in the Constitution. Those concepts were all bigger concepts that really related to the power of the individual. Now, that concept of putting the individual first, back to that Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That's about individualism. Mm-hmm. And they're endowed upon by their creator, whoever it is that you choose, including the nature of the universe, if that's what you want. Mm-hmm. But that there's something beyond mankind that determined that you have these rights as an individual. And amongst those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They changed the pursuit of happiness from property rights. It used to be life, liberty, and property. But they changed it to the pursuit of happiness because Jefferson recognized that different people find happiness in different areas. Now, he really was talking more about meaning, but in talking about meaning, he knew that meaning for some people was, hey, my farm. But for other people, it's my song. It's my piece of art. It's my ability to talk to people. It's my ability to write something that can be handed out. There are many, many ways for you to find meaning in things that you create. And he thought that, and they thought that should be protected. Why? Because they put the individual on top. The whole concept and foundation of who we are was based upon this individual. Now, if you look at the United States today, we are incredibly prosperous, incredibly prosperous. There's no nation in the history of the planet that has the prosperity that we have today. I would argue that that is completely based upon our empowering the individual. That was much more powerful. I love Peter Zion. He does a wonderful job. The idea that we have a discussion about geography with he and Dr. Beckley on the impacts of geography, of our natural rivers, the impact that we have from our demographics. I think all those things are important, and they give us indications of what's going right here and what's going to go wrong in other places like China. But the most powerful thing is that by empowering those individuals, we release the genius of individuals. And what we can see is that there's an evolution that's happening. It started with them saying, hey, all we're going to do is break from the past government to create a more perfect union that's focused on individuals. But oh my gosh, we can all look back then and say, there were like a lot of serious flaws. And then we can go forward 80 years and we can see that the Civil War happened. With the Civil War, we freed the slaves. That was that war. We lost 500,000 Americans to free slaves. We can see it got a little bit better, right? But then we can look at what happened with Native Americans, and we can say, oh gosh, there were some things that happened there that really weren't fair, that weren't right. But we made improvements again. Then we did the suffrage movement that said we're going to include women. Then we decided to do the civil rights, equal rights. Human rights is the big discussion today. And all along the way, we included more individuals. And as we included more individuals, what happened? We had higher productivity. We became more prosperous. There were more buyers, more sellers, more creators. So that's our secret. And that's the ideal that I believe we have to keep driving towards. Now, that ideal only works with free elections, right? If you decide, hey, we can do all of that, but we can do it with a monarchy or we can do it with a party, it is inevitable that those groups become superior to everyone else.
So I want to go back and contrast Platonic idealism with dualism. So Descartes' philosophy about dualism with good and evil, if you can talk about and compare and contrast that with Platonic idealism.
Well, definitely there's a little bit of a conflict and maybe a conflict in some of the shows that we've done because
yes.
We've talked about
the good and evil within us.
The good and evil within
that
us.
That exists within
right?
us. And Solzhenitsyn's philosophy and belief that the inherent detriment to society and the people is exporting our ideology and his belief that the good and evil rests within us. We wrestle with that within us.
Okay, so Platonic idealism, it starts with this belief. The belief was that that in everything that we have, there's an aspirational ideal goal. So I saw someone who talked about the chair. I thought it was a fascinating discussion that originally the chair was probably just something with four legs on it and a seat, right? And then somebody said, boy, that'd sure be nice if we had a back on that, right? And then somebody said, oh man, my butt gets sore when I'm sitting in that chair all day long. And somebody said, hey, well, let's do a cushion, right? And so we continued to evolve chairs that could do all these dramatic things. And effectively what was evolving was the human mind was continually creating a more perfect chair, right? It didn't exist in the beginning. If they had the idea in the beginning, they might have created it. But first, they created something to sit on. And then that something to sit on, they created one that had a back, but still a chair, just a better chair. And then they had an ergonomic design that said, hey, we're going to make certain that that buttocks fits in there just right, right? It was, again, a better chair. The same is true with these goals of courage and truth and individualism and how it is that we create this better society. Now, to answer your question specifically, what Plato believed was that there were two groups of people, those people who reached the idealistic goal, and then those people who didn't and who were squabbling around based upon earthly goods. And his belief was that that focus on earthly goods, material goods, tended to make them less good. It made them less perfect because they didn't have these aspirational goals. They didn't have vision. They weren't idealists. They weren't looking towards what it was that they could create or how it is that they could improve themselves. Now, dualism said, hey, there's really something different going on here. There are these two external forces outside of our body, God and the devil. And these two external forces are both equal forces trying to get us. By the way, I'm not sure what happened in Judaism, but I know Christianity rejected that, right? Christianity rejected that just because they thought that what Plato was talking about was actually a better theory. When we talked about Solzhenitsyn, Solzhenitsyn did not say, hey, there are these two external forces that are trying to get us, good and evil. He did not say that. In fact, he said quite the opposite. He said that inside of each one of us, Solzhenitsyn, of course, for our audience, had spent 20 years in,
in
the Gulag. There were at least millions, maybe tens of millions of people who were killed in the Gulag. It was a huge, horrific event in the course of human history. And oftentimes it's forgotten. Oftentimes it's left aside. But he wrote this book that described very well what happened inside the Gulag. But the point that he made after spending all this horrible time
there...
And
how people were programmed, right?
That's
going
right.
Going back to our topic.
That's right. And I think it was called the Gulag Archipelago. But in any event, he said that... what happened to him when he got there was that instead of blaming Lenin or Stalin or others, he knew that he had to first take accountability of himself. And in taking accountability of himself, he said he had to recognize the wrongs that he had done. The Communist Party had told him that they needed to go move these poor farmers off of their land. Well, they moved them out, moved them into Siberia, and he said that 10,000 families, 60,000 people that he moved, all died. Now, he was a corporal, arguably not the one in charge anyway, but his view was, no.
How to reconcile his responsibility and accountability in human rights abuses.
That's right, but he looked at, how was I able to do that?
Evil.
And he said, I was able to do that because I exported the evil inside of me. I said, no, I'm not evil. We're communist, and because we're communist, and those people are property owners, I need to make certain that I go out and implement this philosophy because they're bad.
Well, we call that justification
in
psychology.
Dualism would say it's an external force of good versus evil that's both attacking us. Solzhenitsyn would say, and I would say, no. Once you export it, once you say they're evil and I'm good, you've begun to give up your responsibility in this process, which is part of what we've been talking about in all these series. You have to take accountability for yourself. What are you saying? You know, it's so easy to blame the you know, what Trump is doing or what the Democrats are doing or what the Republicans are doing or what the media is doing. But you have to take a look at yourself.
Well,
what's the role that you're playing?
To now to look at reprogramming ourselves. I think now that we have the philosophical, theoretical background of where we're driving all of this from, let's give maybe some practical tips and tools and strategies for people how they can reprogram themselves. So what would you start with?
Well, I think that if you were going to start with the idea of yourself, I would start by thinking about the things that program you. All right, how we are individuals that are designed to be programmed. And so, you know, I go back to that music that I was listening to, had a huge effect on me all of a sudden walking around,
eye-sized
baby.
You know, when you said that, I had to think back. I think my brother influenced my parents to listen to Queen. You know, that song, Bismillah, no, we will not let you go. Let me go. That was definitely playing throughout the house. My parents started singing it. It was great. I love Queen.
Well, and so that's... The point is that you have to start by thinking about, all right, how am I being programmed by outside forces?
Yes.
And how do I program myself?
And turn that into habit.
Oh, yes, I agree. First, I start with this. You have to be an idealist with yourself. You have to set a goal for yourself. You have to envision who you are. And you have to go, it has to go farther than what you might normally go. You've got to create an aspirational goal of who you are. Now, in that process, it can become challenging because there are so many things going on in our life that challenge that. But you have to start, you know, in the airplane, they always tell you, take that oxygen mask and put it on yourself first, because you cannot help anyone if you run out of oxygen. So to me, that's the beginning point. It's finding the time and the ability to be able to think, to meditate, to consider who am I Am I who I want to be? Am I doing the things that I want to do? And where is it that I need to go to be able to do that?
Yeah, and one has to really take risks and challenge themselves in order to get there. And I think finding themselves along the way, finding the belief in themselves of their capabilities. So in psychology, we talk a lot about self-esteem, and people will come to me and say, you know, I really low self-esteem. I need to improve my self-esteem. And I think, well, it's not like a magic pill that you just take and all of a sudden you feel more confident about yourself. And it's kind of this fallacy to believe that even exists. But you have to do. It's in the doing. And it's in the information that you get about yourself from other people, from your reality, from your environment, and through your achievements, through your successes, through what you learn through your failures. But it's in the doing. And so I tell people, if you want to improve your confidence and self-esteem, you have to set these aspirational goals for yourself and move towards them. And you'll learn along the way, and you're going to see what you're capable of, what you can tolerate.
I think the don't take risk is one of the most important things. So
To take risks.
Mm-hmm. And people being unwilling to do so. And by the way, that's not just, that exists at all levels, people being willing to be more aspirational. I had a doctor who asked me a question one day. It's a funny question. He said, I own a healthcare company and I'm not a doctor, right? Mm-hmm. I own it with a group of doctors. But nonetheless, we've created a great company. I love it. It's a national platform and it's really bent on trying to change healthcare. Well, this person was a surgeon and he said, hey, he says, I have a question for you. He said, I'm really struggling with this. And I'm struggling with my role and my role that I have in the company. I says, all right, well, help me out. Help me understand what you're thinking about. And he wasn't really talking to me about it as boss and employer. It was two friends talking. He said, okay. He said, look, I don't mean anything bad by this. He said, I'm a surgeon. Mm-hmm. I'm best in class. And I work for you, right?
I am superior to you.
That person has an
inferiority complex.
Well, here's what I asked him. I said, oh, that's simple to understand. I said, you demand perfection. And he said, what do you mean?
Yeah.
And I said, well, let me ask you a question. I said, I'll bet you graduated the top of your class in high school. He goes, oh, I was valedictorian. I said, oh, that's awesome. I said, I'll bet you in college you graduated the top of your class. He says, I was summa cum laude. I said, now you became a surgeon. So my bet is you even did well in medical school. He goes, I was top of my class. He goes, you can't become a surgeon if you're just in the middle part of the class. I said, I'll bet you rarely failed. And he says, I take pride in the fact that I'm successful at everything I do. I said, well, there you go. I fail every single day.
Yeah.
Every day I make a mistake. I make a mistake with employees. I make a mistake with things that I say. I make a mistake with financial risk. Being able to be an entrepreneur partly means being willing to live with making mistakes and taking risks.
And you grow through that struggle.
But
there are struggle muscles that you develop through that process.
But only because what I saw in healthcare when I started was, like, if you go to a doctor's office, take a look at where most of the doctors park. And you'll find in many, many, if not most practices, the doctors have the shaded parking and it's closest to the front door, right? Why? Well, because doctors are prestigious. Look at any other business and look at who's closest to the front door with the shaded parking.
The prestige is a fallacy. Yeah. And I think the important thing to separate here is, looking at your life and the standards that you have and the conditions that you lived and the struggle muscles that you've developed through your failures, and what you've learned about yourself through your successes, it's not based on those external achievements. And I think it lends itself to suicide. So people who have amassed amazing things and achievements and money and status and prestige and all those things, as soon as you take those away, they feel like their life is meaningless, that they have nothing left inside.
And I think that when you begin to focus on those, back to Plato, mm-hmm. you're focused on the material things, right?
Yes.
And to me, the reason I'm willing to endure success is because I have an aspirational goal. The aspirational goal for my healthcare company is, number one, it needs to be focused on the customer. I fail at that, but we have an aspirational goal to make certain that they're the priority, not the doctor, not the entrepreneur, not the financial resources, but the people that are coming through that front door. The second thing that I care about is we have a healthcare system that does very well for people who are at the top end of the economic bracket. But many, many companies literally will only have health insurance for 10 or 15 or 20% of their employees. Why? Because it costs too much money. Mm-hmm. It's too expensive. So the question becomes, how can you create a company that has lower cost, but still has better outcomes and a better experience? That's our aspirational goal. I'm not telling you that we're always successful at it. We're a company, right? But what I am telling you is that I'm willing to take those risks, to set that aspirational goal, to recognize that I have failure, to try to learn from that failure, and to get better constantly to improve the product. Now, my friend who was a surgeon, he's so focused on every surgery has to be perfect that everything in his life then has to begin to become perfect.
And it probably always comes back to himself, his self-worth and his value. And the danger, you know, we were talking about exporting idealism or exporting your beliefs. The danger is, what are you left with? Because you're always going to be seeking and searching. Mm-hmm. If you have that confidence and belief in yourself, which you gain from experience, which you gain from testing your limits, which you gain from finding your true capabilities and capacities, knowing that you can surpass what you thought you couldn't ever achieve, that's resilience. Mm-hmm. That's what builds you. That's where you derive your self-worth and value from.
Now, I was fortunate. We grew up, much of our family grew up in trailer parks, but we grew up in very poor neighborhoods. And I learned through that process that we could always go back and play music and enjoy ourselves. It wasn't the end of life that I
never
didn't have all the material goods.
Never base your value on how much income you make. Never base your value on how big your house is or the fancy car that you drive.
I mean, we both know this show's not being done for money. That's not why we're doing it, right? This takes a lot of our time. It takes a lot of our effort. We don't get paid to do this.
That's right.
But we have an aspirational goal. We want to try to...
And it's our passion. Actually, I would love for you to describe what the sexton means for you for this show.
Well, the whole reason that the sexton became
really
became the symbol of the show is that that there were people who decided to cross the Atlantic. And they crossed the Atlantic to try to find a better life. They didn't like the life that they were living in England. They didn't like the life that they were living where they felt like they were under someone else's thumb. They forged their way across the oceans and they forged their way across the United States. But when they came across that ocean, there was no passage that told them how to get there. The way that they got there was by setting their sights by the stars. And what the sexton did is it gave them the ability to take a look at those stars and to determine their way to be able to get to this new land, this newfound land. It's incredible that one little device that you're looking up on that wall was the tool that they used to be able to get here. And that without it, they may have very well failed, right? That happens over and over again. That device has had an incredible effect. But what are they really doing? They're setting their sights by the stars and not by the lights of every passing ship.
And
right, because there were no passing ships.
Exactly. Yeah, there was no one that was set before them to follow that path. The beauty in that, I love that. Thank you for sharing that. The beauty in that, in which I think translates very practically to people and even in the clinical work that I do, is people are paralyzed by taking risks because what happens next is unpredictable. And they're so focused on what they might lose as a result of it or the humiliation that they may have as a result of it by sounding stupid or looking stupid or losing money or losing friends. Mm-hmm. These are so common. And most people have those fears. Mm-hmm. And that is human.
You know, I think one of the things that we should hit on also is you're right, people have those fears. And we have to be able to address our fears. And we have to take risks. Those are important. But to accomplish both of those, one of the things that you and I have talked about is you have to stop lying to yourself.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for mentioning that. And I think, this was a really important point that you brought up, and I'm going to mention it again, because that lack of predictability, people do not feel secure. They do not feel like they have a sense of control. And ultimately, that's what holds them back. And people will get caught up in these lies and self-deception. They'll betray themselves. And they won't have these aspirational goals that are true for themselves. They might be somebody else's aspirational goals for themselves, like their mother or their spouse or their other person who loves them, but they're not theirs. Mm-hmm. They're not going to have the motivation to graduate high school, to attain a full-time job, to move out of the house, to be a better parent, to be a better spouse, if it's not truly inherent in themselves.
And boy, that is, I think that's something you have to start with, asking yourself, what do I really want?
Yeah.
Because for,
and have the courage to ask yourself
I define courage as changing the world. Mm-hmm. But I have some family members who are much better human beings than me who say, hey, my aspirational goal is courage. And mm-hmm. Their focus is, I want the courage to be able to make certain that I'm the best dad that I can be. Mm-hmm. And every time I hear that, I get choked up,
yeah.
Right? That's aspirational.
Yeah.
It's just as aspirational.
How you define it.
It's how you define it.
It's
and it's
on
up
an
to
individual
you.
Basis.
It's subjective mm-hmm. in how you define it. Mm-hmm. But you should at least start with, I want to create a better me. I want to be idealistic mm-hmm. when it comes to me. And I want to think through, what are the things that I want? Now, the lying to yourself, you know, a friend of mine worked on people with weight. I found this to be fascinating. He said, I promise you, if you will come in and work out for 5 minutes a day, just 5 minutes a day, mm-hmm. he said, I will help you lose 100 pounds. Mm-hmm. All right. People, of course, didn't believe it. He goes, I need you to do it for 30 days. So what he would do is he'd put him on a treadmill. He'd have him go in, get dressed out, get ready to work out. He'd put him on a treadmill. And he says, I just need you to walk on this treadmill for 5 minutes a day. So they'd walk for 5 minutes. And when they'd get done walking, say, okay, we're done. Let's stop. Then they'd go over and they'd have a nice tea or have a cup of coffee. And he'd talk to him for a while and they'd go home. Well, at the end of a month, he started saying, it's 4 minutes. I'm kind of in a rush. Let's go ahead and go. What he found is, after he got them to being in a habit of having 30 days, they'd go, no, I said 5 minutes. I'm going to do my 5 minutes. All right. Why? Because they'd built up a practice of telling themselves the truth for 2 or 3 weeks over and over and over again. Repetition and the pattern matters.
It definitely helps. And that will also adjust your behaviors and your lifestyle choices, and it will be easier to maintain. I have a different example about stop lying to yourself. So I know someone who has a really challenging past and survived quite a lot of hardships and is so focused on her son and daughter's failures and lack of successes and poor achievements to her standards, that it's causing her to be blindsided and not see her own disappointments in herself. And if I were to hold that mirror up, oh my gosh, she would find a gazillion reasons why it's not as imperative as focusing on the disappointments of others. And so she's continuing to lie to herself, but through projecting her own disappointments of herself onto her children, that is creating so much harm, because now she's perpetuating the same inner story into her children that she has of herself.
So how's she lying to herself?
You are not good enough. You are not good enough.
That her children are good enough, or that she's not good enough?
That's her belief of herself, which is being projected onto her children.
Okay.
And that is the story and the narrative that she's not willing to accept is going on inside of her. Until she can be honest with herself and see that she has this inner struggle and inner story that's preventing her from actualizing her best self and her best potential, she's going to be stuck because she's mm-hmm. constantly deceiving herself.
Mm-hmm.
And that is self-betrayal. And she's harming her children through
the process.
Do you
find people also self-sabotage themselves sometimes?
Yes. Yeah.
How does that
so,
happen?
Another story, I know someone who is really living his mother's dream and not his dream for himself. And he feels that he's so far into debt and going through medical school that there's no way that he can quit school. He now has $500,000 debt. he thinks it's a worthy cause and a worthy goal, and it's something he would like to do. But it's his mother's passion ultimately, and he hasn't really found the motivation because it's not really his dream. But he's going to try, but he's not going to try fully, because if, let me put myself into his position, if I were to try 100% and put everything I had into succeeding and filling all the requirements for medical school and still failing, well, now that has something to say about my self-worth and value, because now it's proven that I'm not good enough. Now it's proven that I'm not worthy enough. Now it's proven that I'm incompetent and inadequate. If I hold something back and not put myself fully in, then if I still don't succeed, at least there's some self-preservation of my ego. And the risk is the other way out might be suicide, because I'll fantasize about that. Because if I can't see an escape, my mind will go to suicide as another form of escape. That's that if I don't see any other options that are viable to no longer endure this pain and hardship, that's where my mind will go. The risk is actually attempting.
Yeah. And there, again, I'm not a psychologist. I only dealt with this from a sociological standpoint, being mayor and working with employees and working with citizens. But I have found over and over again that people have to find meaning and they have to find motivation. And, you know, motivation, there's a very simple formula. I've used it over and over again. It definitely works, which is you have to start by deciding, hey, is this what I want to do? That has to be the starting point. What is this what I want to do? And you can't live a lie, all right? You can't lie to yourself, but you also can't live a lie, right? You can't say, I am someone that I'm really not. I want to do something that I really don't want to do. You have to figure out who you are and what you want. Then you have to find motivation to do it, because even then, after you work at it for a while, it can get boring or it can begin to become rote. You start to lose the enthusiasm. Well, here are the three things that it takes to motivate someone. Number one, you have to challenge them, right? They have to have a challenge set in front of them constantly that gives them an ability to see that they can make themselves better. Two, you have to pat them on the back when they see progress. And three, when they're done, they have to be able to recount their growth. Now, if you're doing that for yourself, if you know, hey, I need to find a way to make myself motivated, then you need to be very clear on what the challenge is so that you can give yourself credit for what you're doing while you're doing it. And then you have to be able to look back and say, here's how I grew. Now what's my next step? And that keeps people motivated. But if you lose that, you become in trouble. Now, have you ever heard of Price's Law?
No.
All right. I love Price's Law. Price's Law says that he did a study of companies across the United States. And he said that if you look at the amount of work that's done in each company, that 50% of the work is done by the square root of the total. Now, think about this for a moment. If you have nine people in a company, that means out of nine people, three people did half the work. But if you have 100 people in a company, that means 10 people did half the work. If you have 10,000 people in a company, that means 100 people did half of the work. Now, you could use that as an employer to say, man, I got a lot of employees that aren't doing what they're supposed to do. But to me, Price's Law was much more valuable to the individual who is in a position where maybe they're the one that's not being productive. You should always start by asking yourself this question. Am I providing value here? Am I providing value back to the company, back to the customer, back to the people who are there? And if you're not, do everybody a favor. Go find a place where your skills are providing someone a value. Do yourself a favor and do everyone else a favor. So if you know that you're going to school and you hate it and you're unhappy and you're going to self-sabotage, maybe you should think about, are you providing value there? And if you're not, take a look at where could you provide value with those skills.
And self-fulfillment. I think, you know, that is going to be the biggest self-motivating factor. If you're finding inherent interest and joy, you're feeling, you're experiencing growth, you like the people who are in it. There's maybe people you admire that you're learning from, mentors that you can find in that. there's so many things in this life and world, and I think it's a matter of finding what are your true talents.
All right, so let's go through the negatives that someone might face.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, and maybe this is where you're going, you know, some of the things that might hold somebody else back. So we talked about procrastination and self-sabotage. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that some of my clients will say to me is, Dr. Basha, I have had so much loss in my life. And I've worked with people who have survived war, real war. They were dislocated from their homes, separated permanently from their families, had no way of knowing if people were surviving, were like living in camps and tents, and had really minimal nutrition and basic needs that were met. And so they say to me, you know, I've known war or loss or death or trauma, tragedy, all these things. Why should I believe in a future? Why should I even put effort and energy into something that's worth living for? Because I don't ultimately believe that exists. And so that's hard. That's hard to change a person's mindset if they don't even have that belief that something better could exist for them. Why should I apply for a job? I'm just going to get rejected anyway. Why should I go to school to get a degree so I can work for somebody else and do something that isn't going to provide me any satisfaction or value?
So how do you help them find idealism?
Well, grief is a powerful thing. And I think acknowledging the grief and loss and being realistic and practical about what that grief is and how you can transform yourself from the grief, there has to be a healing that happens. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is an amazing researcher, and she's written a lot on the topic of grief and loss. And one of the things that she says is, the reality is you will never stop grieving. The goal is to not get over the grief.
I believe she did the stages of grief.
Yes. But one of the things, this is a powerful quote, she said, you will never get over the grief. Imagine your life worthy of living, where you can feel fulfillment and happiness, but you're allowing yourself to be transformed by the grief. And there's honor in that process. That is growing the struggle muscles that you were talking about that differentiated you from that medical doctor. Mm-hmm. And that's where you have that inherent sense of self-worth. There may be some days that you may be reminded of a lost loved one, and you might laugh and think, oh, if they were here to enjoy this, they would have said this and this. And there may be some days that you might cry because you'd say, oh, this is the best moment of my life. I just birthed a child. I just got married. I just graduated. I just got my degree. And my mother wasn't here to see it. You know, and so it's inextricable. It is juxtaposed with loss. Life is juxtaposed with loss. So never think that we can just separate it and be this Pollyannish, joyful person. It's what gives us strength. And it's going to be consistent. It's going to follow. The grief will just be at the bottom and it'll be consistent. Doesn't mean that you can never experience joy. Believe you will experience joy again. Believe that you will be okay when your parents die. Believe that you will be okay if you survive your spouse. Believe that you will be okay if something else traumatic or tragic happened. We won't know. We can't predict the future. Things will happen to us. Change is inevitable. 100% statistically true. Everyone we love will die one day, including us. We can spend our whole lives resisting that and being in denial of it, and yet it's true. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross developed the stages of grief, and she said, you know, and now we know with research and also applications of this, that it's not a linear process. It's circular. People can bounce back and forth. People can spend their whole life in one stage. But their depression, anger, bargaining, denial, and acceptance. And ultimately, we want to get to acceptance. And again, that's what I was describing before. It's that you can still live a life worth living for despite all of these losses. Allow yourself to integrate it. Give yourself permission to experience joy again. Create meaning, create hope, believe that is possible for you. Have those aspirational goals that we talked about. I have a family member that is probably still in the bargaining phase over my grandfather's disappearance. Mm-hmm. He said to himself during a family interview, if I only went out and prevented him from going to the coffee shop that day, then the bath party wouldn't have abducted my father and he might still be alive today. He still holds on to that belief. It's been 50 years, more, maybe more, that had he done that, that's bargaining. Mm-hmm. And so if you're in that if only, so one of the main theories that is driving all of this here is you can never be better than your belief about yourself. Those beliefs come from our childhood. They may come from our experiences, our self-doubts, our fears, all of those things become programmed that we were talking about before, but we can never surpass those. People around us can believe all these things about us and encourage us and inspire us and want us to be this better person. But inherently, if we're self-destructive and we're living in denial, or if we're lying to ourselves, or if we're not seeing what's blinding us, we're impervious to those blind spots, we're never going to grow to our full potential. And we may not even believe that we're lovable. Mm-hmm. And so we're constantly going to be pushing people away and then complaining that we don't have a loving relationship.
Yeah, idealism as it applies to itself is equally as important. That to me is what I get out of that quote. The idea that we cannot be better, any better than the image that we have of ourselves. Mm-hmm. Reality starts with the image of who we are. It's the image of what we would think would be the more perfect self. Now, let's talk, if we can, a little bit before we're done, about the whole concept of working with other people.
Yes.
Right, that there are other people that you have a responsibility to, people that you have to try to set goals for, aspirational goals, idealistic goals for, to make them better.
You know, one of the things that I do with my clients, and I will tell them this, is I accept you for who you are today, despite your limitations, despite your fears, despite you lying to yourself, despite your baggage that you bring in. But I will always be expecting more from you. Mm-hmm. And I'll always be requesting more from you. And I'll always be demanding a little bit more from you. Doesn't mean that I'm not accepting of you, and I'm not doing it in a judgmental way. I'm not rejecting you. I'm accepting you, but I'm always going to be expecting more.
What do you do when a client doesn't work hard enough?
I have to reformulate what is going on. You know, sometimes I might get trapped and play the role of someone that they love, and I might be enabling them. And that's one of the hardest things is looking at, am I fostering a dependency here? Mm-hmm. And I'll have a real heart to heart with them and say, okay, I'm stuck. I don't feel like we're moving forward. This is how I'm seeing what's going on. What are your perceptions? Where am I falling short in what you need from me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find as an employer, this is an important issue, but I like Viktor Frankl's mm-hmm. comment on this. He does, you can Google it and look it up. He gave a great speech on this whole concept. But the basics of it are this. He said, as a psychologist, but I would apply this to being an employer, a father, to being a friend, that you have to set an aspirational goal and you have to be an idealist as it comes to the people that surround you. And you have to help them set aspirational goals that are farther than what maybe they can even accomplish. Because again, what Viktor Frankl pointed out is that human beings cannot help themselves. There are so many things that happen in their life that if they set a goal as to what it is that they see as being perfect, that they'd like to get to, that they face headwinds, that things happen in their life, the shortages of money, people passing away, hardships that take place. And so no matter what, they never quite get to the goal, mm-hmm. right? But he said, that's okay. However, if you set the goal at mediocrity, or if you set the goal at where they are, they won't go beyond that. They'll just mm-hmm. stay right there. You have to help them envision a goal that goes beyond that. And again, all of this always mm-hmm. comes back to visualization. What would that look like? What would that be? How would you become that person? And what would life be like if that actually took place, if those goals took place? You know, I tried to develop a long time ago things that were goals for me in my life to accomplish what I wanted. And I'm not talking about just my mantra. I'm talking about, you know, I believe that in what we're doing today, one of my goals is be fearless.
Yes.
Right? Why? Well, because what are we talking about here? We're talking about trying to improve other people in the process. Again, with no pay, not that I'm complaining, I didn't do this for pay.
There may be other self-serving factors, but yeah.
Absolutely. There are always self-serving factors. I feel better.
I feel challenged. Right? I definitely feel like I'm growing, you know, and it causes us to read and challenge and talk through some of these deeper philosophical issues and find our own truths and say in the end, well, maybe this is my belief right now, but it could evolve.
But what I do as an example with employees is I constantly, no matter what the problem is, I try to bring them back to the aspirational goal for the company. What are we trying to do? We're trying to make certain that more people can afford healthcare. We're trying to make certain that more people have access to healthcare and that the people at the bottom two quartiles end up being included in the system. And we want to do that while improving the outcome, improving the experience, and dropping costs.
And I believe in it, creating a healthier community and contributing towards the health of our community.
Now, then what I get them to is, what's the role that you want to play in that? How would you see your role, the things that you do, as being important to that? Why is it important to that?
And set the expectations for yourself and others.
Well, I set the expectation for the company, but I find with employees, I can't be the savior.
No.
I have to be the coach, right? My partner is very good at being a coach. But I find that when I'm working with other people, I have to help coach them to getting to where I want to get them to. Because when I try to be the savior, lo and behold, I become the victim, right? Because over time,
get trapped in that role.
Well, not only do I give them the perfect way that they could do it, I then also come up with the perfect way to get that done. And then I tell them what are the exact steps that they need to do that. And then I go monitor each one of those steps to make sure that they're being done. And then maybe they succeed that time, but then the problem happens again. Once I get them to self-visualize it on their own and to think about their own action steps and whether or not they actually buy into the greater mission, I improve the chances that that portion of my company that isn't included in the square root portion, as in Price's law that are producing half the work, I start to find that they become more productive because they're empowered.
I would challenge you to think of it this way, that you're inspiring them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Rather than, because you said, I would get them to do this, and it almost sounds like you're, you know, manipulating and controlling.
No,
maybe that is
I was trying,
inspiring.
What I was trying to say is, I don't want to micromanage them.
No.
I want them to be
able to believe in it. In the cause.
And the greater way to get that done is to not be the savior.
Personally.
It's to be a coach, to coach them towards what it is that they want. All right. So let's just turn back to kind of reviewing and trying to cover the big lessons that we have here. To me, the first lesson is the importance of being an idealist. And that as Plato said, the whole idea of ideals is to set a higher standard, and that what we actually imagine ends up becoming more true than reality. Now, the greater traits to be an idealist on are the traits of truth, courage, honesty, but we need to be an idealist for ourselves, for the people that surround us, and we need to be an idealist for our country as well. To me, that ends up being one of the highest priorities.
Yes. And then I would say number two is take risks. You're never going to know your true potential. It is unlimited, but let's at least see how close we could get to it, right? And the more that you drive yourself to that, you're going to really be able to see your true capabilities and capacities. That's going to improve your competence. That's going to improve your mastery of skills. That's going to improve your self-confidence. And your belief that you're going to be able to get through whatever challenges or struggles may be presented to yourself. The belief that you're going to overcome things and you're not going to be paralyzed by loss of control, loss of power, or if things are unpredictable by nature. You're going to be excited and challenged by it and striving towards it. So that is optimal. That's where we want to go.
All right. Programming ourselves. first you have to acknowledge that we are, by nature, we're programmable, that everything that happens to us in life begins to program us. And you are confronting, everyone is confronting huge headwinds. The negative information that is flowing at you is having an effect on programming your thinking. The nightly news, the negative media, the political parties, candidates. You have to take control over programming yourself and to make certain that the information that you're getting in is positive information, optimistic information, information that helps you think about how can I become a more ideal person with more ideal characteristics? What does that look like? And so by so doing so, you start to find more opportunities.
Yes. The next one I would say, I'll say a quote of Gandhi, be the change that you want to see in the world. You know, if you're striving towards changing the world and to being a better person that lives and exists in this space that is ideal for you, you have to take those incremental steps, have that long-term vision, but be that change. And you're going to do that through taking risks and belief and having faith and having hope and all those other things. It's going to be hard and you'll grow those struggle muscles through the process, but you have to be the change that you want to see in the world.
The next one for me is you have to stop lying to yourself. It is so important that when we set these aspirational goals, that we recognize that that's the place that we'd like to end up, and that we know that it will evolve, that as we start to move towards those aspirational goals, just like our country has, just like our companies do, that those goals will shift for us. But it's so easy in the process to lie to yourself. And the lies oftentimes can be little lies. I'm not going to eat those French fries. Then you do. I'm going to work out today. Then you don't. I'm going to work out three times this week. And then you don't. I'm going to go learn something today. Then you don't. I'm going to read optimistic news. Then you don't, right? You have to start with setting goals that build habits. And the way to keep yourself from lying is to focus on creating those habits that help you become more programmable.
Wonderful. And the last that I would say is, you know, having faith and belief in the ability to see things that don't yet exist.
I love that. Yep, that's a great one. All right, Emily, we very much appreciate you being
Thank
here,
you,
Dr.
Paul.
Bascia. And this will finish up our seventh series. I know that next season we're looking at doing just a whole focus on many of these same types of issues just because of the response that we've gotten from our audience. So thanks again.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks for joining the Optimistic American Show. Now help us grow by subscribing to our channel. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a like and a comment. There is so much more that we have planned. We can't wait for you to embark upon this journey with us.